Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rohenbacher.
And you know what? I think it's high time we start talking about some really deep topics, huh?
Yes, very deep today. In RTB 101, we're going to be hearing from medical doctor Francisco Delgado on his journey to faith.
And in Give and Take, Jeff Swearing will be interviewing astrophysicist Hugh Ross about the moon's magnetic field making life possible. Pretty cool.
First up is Culture Talk. Sandra and theologian Gavin Ortland will discuss why God makes sense in a world that doesn't. Let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk. This is the segment where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And today I am joined with pastor and author of a number of books, including Why God Makes Sense in a World That Doesn't. This is Gavin Ortland. Thank you, Gavin, for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, I'm happy to talk about your book. I'm really excited about it. It's going to be coming out in late October. Can you tell us, this is something that we always think about within the editorial world, is what's the felt need? So what is the felt need that your book is addressing?
Well, one of the things that I've experienced a lot in the last few years is friends who've deconstructed their faith, or Christian friends who are trying to help their other friends who've deconstructed their faith. There's actually this whole movement right now, which is really concerning, of how common these stories are of deconstruction. And as I have listened to these testimonies, I've kind of had the feeling that there's some unique characteristics to some of these stories that are a little different from maybe some of the struggles people had 20 years ago. Yeah. I think one of the things that's on my mind is just the sense of disillusionment that a lot of people have. And I don't think that calls for a totally new approach to apologetics, but I do think it should flavor things a little bit. And the way we make an approach can sometimes be more winsome for that particular kind of person who's really struggling. And so the book really draws attention to the sort of affective and emotional sides of these various different arguments for the existence of God, and trying to show not just that this is plausible, but also what is at stake. You know, the emotional difference between a theistic worldview and a naturalistic worldview in which there's nothing beyond nature. That is profound. It's the difference in, the more I've thought about that, I really think it's the difference between beauty and enchantment on the one hand, and chaos and meaninglessness on the other, ultimately. And so I hope the book will be helpful for the for people who are struggling and working through these questions today. I know what it's like to struggle with those questions, and I really hope the book will kind of touch upon those needs.
Right. Well, I love the way that you've described your book. And I know that the book actually reimagines four classical theistic arguments in order to appeal to the heart and imagination, or the beauty and enchantment, as you were saying. In what way does your book kind of reimagine these arguments?
Okay, so in each case, I go through these four arguments, and in each case, I'm trying to show what is at stake here. Emotionally, but that's kind of too small of a word, just the full implications, you know, what actually is the consequence either way you go. So the book starts with a cosmological argument, which is the argument for God as the first cause of the universe. And it's trying to say it's much more plausible to have a cause like a personal God. But then I spend the second half of the chapter saying it's much more interesting. It leads to a much more expansive worldview. I think I used the metaphor at one point of it's as though you spent your whole life in the basement. You've never been outside. You didn't know that there were waterfalls or trees or stars. And then one day you see a staircase and you see light creeping through the bottom of the door. And you think, what could be out there? Anything could be out there. And I say, that's like what it feels like to go from a naturalistic to a theistic worldview. You go from this cramped, restricted thing to this absolutely massive world of possibilities. And then I do the same thing with other arguments. The argument for God from design, I say, enhances the sense of nobility and dignity to the world. The argument for God from morality enhances the sense of the meaning of our lives and the moral struggle we all face. And it gives hope. And then the last argument, I say, basically for human happiness and for the hope of history, makes all the difference. Do we believe in an afterlife or not? And ultimately, that makes a profound difference for whether life is even worth living. And I don't think that affective or emotional side of things is enough in and of itself, but I think joining that with the rational side really adds something potent to the whole appeal. I know it does for me, at least.
Right. And I love that you've separated things into different chapters so that you're able to focus on each theme. So you have the cause of the world, the meaning of the world, the conflict of the world, and the hope of the world. So let's just dive into one of those and let's talk about the conflict of the world. How would you use the conflict of the world when talking with someone who either is in the middle of kind of just unpacking their faith and kind of deconstructing it, or someone who is at least open to exploring the possibility of faith?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I just draw attention to the fact that all of us have this profound sense of good and evil, and that the difference between them really matters. Most people don't need to be argued into that. Most people can accept that, yeah, there are some things that are good, there are some things that are evil, and the difference between those two is really significant. And I'd spend some time drawing attention to that through literature, through philosophy, through movies. So, you know, one of the interesting clues about morality comes in the stories we tell. All cultures tell stories, and our culture's dominant form of storytelling is probably movies. And it's just interesting. It's so common, we don't even think about it, but every movie is about good and evil. Mm-hmm. And it has the same pattern over and over. Good and evil are fighting, and eventually good triumphs over evil. And so then the question becomes, okay, so we've got this sense, you know, all human beings have this set of moral instincts that we, through which we look at the world. And then we ask, well, what's the best explanation for that? And it turns out, in a naturalistic worldview, these feelings of morality are kind of an illusion. It's just something fobbed off on us by the evolutionary process that helped animals survive. But there's actually no, you know, what we think of great, terrible atrocities in human history, and they're really not qualitatively different from in the animal kingdom when a stronger animal devours a weaker animal. That's just the way the world works. But on a theistic worldview, we're able to look at good and evil and see that they are significant, that that feeling of significance isn't an illusion. That's actually a clue to the meaning of the world. And I find that not only more plausible, but more hopeful. I really find it unlivable. And I think most people would, if they really trace it through and think through the implications, if you really arrive upon a full-blown nihilistic worldview where there's no transcendent deity or supernatural reality, the moral conflict of the world really does reduce down to something I think very few human beings can even accept, because it's so dark. Mm-hmm. And so this is just one of the reasons, as I've worked through these things in my own life at a personal level, I'm so profoundly grateful for my Christian faith. It gives me categories by which to make sense of the world that make it makes more sense of the world, but it's also so much more emotionally satisfying.
Right. Well, you talk about what it would look like, what we would expect from a naturalistic worldview as far as good and evil and what they mean, but what would we expect to see then from a Christian worldview?
Well, we would think of good and evil as real, significant categories that reflect the character of God. Mm-hmm. So good is objective because it reflects his character and therefore his will for us. So when we feel a deep indignation at injustice, that's not an illusory feeling. There's a reason why we feel that way, and that feeling is totally valid. And I think someone who's a naturalist will have those feelings as well, but the difference will be, do you have a worldview that makes sense of them at both an intellectual and at an emotional level?
Well, thank you so much. There's so much more to learn about these topics, and I really hope that people will pick up your book. But first, how can they find you and find out more about your writings?
Yeah, thank you so much. Two ways. One would be on YouTube. I run a YouTube channel called Truth Unites. I've just started it a little less than a year ago, and I do apologetics work on there and also ecumenical dialogue. and theology. And then I also have a website at just gavinortland.com, and people can find out about books and where I'm at on social media and those kinds of things on my website.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. So viewers, if you want to find out more about this topic, look for Why God Makes Sense in a World That Doesn't, Gavin Ortland's book that's coming out in late October, wherever you can buy your books.
Does scientific advance make it difficult to believe that God exists? Or can scientific discoveries point the way to God's existence? I'm joined today by Dr. Francisco Delgado, who is a Christian and a physician who practices in the treatment of infectious diseases, to help unpack these questions. Paco, we've been talking quite a bit about the idea that there's scientific evidence for God's existence, and you clearly are a man of science and a man of faith. And many times what I find when I engage people that are skeptics, that are non-believers, they tend to dismiss scientists who are Christians as being simply people who just grew up in a Christian home, and that's the reason why they're Christians. So let me ask you, did you grow up in a Christian home? Is that the reason why you're a Christian?
No, not at all, Fuss. I grew up in a nominal Catholic family. When I went to the university, I got involved with the sciences. I had started in the engineering tract, but then science drew me, and I essentially was completely involved with sciences. To me, that became a most amazing worldview because of its explanatory power. Mm-hmm. But then there were some events that happened in my life. I actually turned to God and I said, if you exist, I don't want to know anything about you. Go your way. Don't come next to me.
So you had an attitude of almost rebellion against God.
It was actually full against him, fully against him. But then I fell into this very deep depression. It was actually to the point of suicide. And it was during one of those days that I picked up a book that wasn't even necessarily related to the Bible, but I was passing the pages, and Galatians 2:20 was quoted there. It is not no more me, but God who lives in me. And whatever I live in the flesh, I live it under the Son of God. The room really was filled with this amazing brightness. And all of a sudden, in an instant, that major depression that I had was completely gone. And I was filled with this sense of joy, overwhelming joy that I had never felt before.
You know, that's really very interesting that you would say that, because in a sense, your story somewhat parallels my story. Now, I don't think I was ever angry at God, but I just didn't really care if God existed or not. And it was scientific discoveries about the nature of the cell's chemistry that convinced me there was a creator. But I was reading the Sermon on the Mount, exploring the Christian faith at that point, and had an overwhelming sense that there was a presence in the room just as real as you are. And then I had this overwhelming sense that what I'm reading in Scripture is true, that Jesus is who Christians claim him to be. So it's fascinating to me to hear your story, that you had this religious experience that drew you to the Christian faith. So
what happened later is the only thing that I could say at that point was, who are you? But I didn't hear anything compared to, you know, what now I know Paul asked. And, you know, I didn't hear any other audible voice. But that set me on a path to figure out who had been in that room with me. So now I know that, for example, a worldview has three tests of truth. One of them is the experiential relevance. I had an experience, but how did I know that this experience was true, was real? So I embarked into this study of multiple religions, and it wasn't really difficult to figure out that this was Jesus Christ who had been in that room with me. I continued the study and essentially applied the other tests of truth, which are logical consistency and empirical adequacy, and I essentially found that the Christian worldview was extremely robust in all of its explanatory power beyond what I had seen even in the sciences.
So that's fascinating. Now, what would you say to somebody who would say to you, well, this religious experience was just some kind of hallucination that you had?
That's a very good question. You know, all the experiences that we have as human beings really cannot be dismissed, because your experience as a human is very different than mine. And I could really dismiss any experience as, oh, you're just dreaming about it. But we cannot apply that test to everyday life. However, we can see the worldview of the person that has had that experience and figure out if it really makes sense. Because if it really makes sense, if there is an experiential transformation of the individual, then we'd better pay attention to what's happening there.
Well, you know, there's an interesting argument for God's existence called the argument from religious experience. And one of the people whose name is most often associated that is with Richard Swinburne. And he argues that in a court of law, if somebody recounts an experience that they had, that we our orientation is to accept that eyewitness account or that experience as being true unless we have a reason to reject that we know that that person is mentally ill or that person is unreliable. And so I think it's interesting that it's the principle of testimony that Swinburne brings to these ideas of religious experience. And, you know, and so I think in your case, you could apply that, right? And say,
absolutely.
You know, you don't seem to be someone who's dishonest. You know, there's no motivation you would have for making this up. How would you react to Swinburne's evaluation of the test for religious experience?
You know, we really, I cannot dismiss what somebody tells me. Because an experience may mean something for that person, but if it is an isolated fact, or if it is something that does not go along with the world that we know, with reality, then I don't see why we need to take it.
So then the bottom line is, we've kind of meandered all over the place here a little bit, but the bottom line is then that you didn't grow up in a Christian home, and that you actually came to faith in Christ as a person who is pursuing studies and a career in the sciences, not the other way around, where you were first a Christian and then as you learned about science, you just appropriated that into your Christian worldview.
That is correct. I was really against even thinking about anything from God. I was running away from Him.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink. Welcome back to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we look at important scientific ideas and look at how they demonstrate the truth of Christianity. We're joined again today by founder and president of Reasons to Believe, Dr. Hugh Ross, and we're going to be investigating the moon's early magnetic field. Hugh, good to have you here today.
Well, thank you.
So when we talk about the moon, magnetic fields generally aren't even on the map. It seems to have such a small, irrelevant magnetic field. Does the moon even have a magnetic field?
It's got a very weak magnetic field. They call it an historical magnetic field because it's basically a tiny leftover remnant from what it had in the beginning.
Okay, so kind of give us a little bit of background. How, you know, it has a very small one today. Did it have one in the past? How did it get it? And why was it larger than it is today?
Yeah, definitely had one in the past. In its first billion years, it did have a significant magnetic field. A magnetic field about as strong as the Earth's. Hmm. And the reason why is because of how the moon formed. It formed as a result of two planets colliding and merging together. Theia colliding with the Earth, mm-hmm. making a bigger Earth, but a byproduct was the formation of the moon. And so that meant that the moon formed in a high temperature regime, which means the iron in its core was in a liquid state. So for the first billion years of its history, the moon had a liquid iron core. Now, that by itself will not get you a magnetic field. You have to find some way to circulate mm-hmm. that liquid iron. But with the way the moon formed, it means that it began very close to the Earth, way closer than it is right now. And so what astronomers discovered is when it's closer than, say, 30 moon diameters away from the Earth, you get sufficient tidal interaction between the Earth and the moon that it circulates the liquid iron in its core, which generates a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm. So you've got the moon being much closer to the Earth, which is going to tidally lock it so that the same
face always faces, so it's not going to spin, which is where Earth gets its magnetic field, because the Earth spins.
Well, what's happening is that the Earth's gravitational pull in the near side of the moon is a lot stronger than it is on the far side, and this actually causes the moon to wobble. You get a wobbling effect.
Okay.
There's still a wobble effect today, but it's very tiny.
Right.
But back then it would have been much more dramatic, and that would have circulated the liquid iron. The other thing is Earth is small enough compared to the moon that the moon's gravitational pull on the Earth would have also caused the Earth to wobble, and therefore the Earth's liquid iron core also was circulating. And so if it wasn't for the moon being as massive as it is and as near as it was to the Earth at that time, Earth's magnetic field would have been much weaker. So it makes a strong magnetic field in the early Earth, a strong magnetic field in the early moon, and they're close enough together the magnetic fields actually couple.
Well, yeah, okay. So you're making, you're going to reference an article here in a little bit where you're making the claim that the magnetic field of the moon is important for humanity being here. That seems a pretty bold claim, especially since we're talking about stuff over 4 billion years ago.
Well, the problem is 4 billion years ago, you got an active sun.
Okay.
Sun pouring on a lot more flaring energy than it is today, a lot more X-ray and ultraviolet radiation. And without a coupled magnetic field, a strong coupled magnetic field, solar radiation at that time would have sputtered away all of Earth's water and all of Earth's atmosphere. And if that had happened, our planet would have been permanently sterile.
So it's not just humans, it's all life.
All life would be gone, exactly.
Okay, so you've got the moon because of its close proximity. What actually played out there that made that possible to keep the atmosphere of Earth from sputtering away?
Well, Earth's magnetic field by itself would not have been strong enough and durable enough to prevent the solar radiation at that time from eradicating our atmosphere and our ocean. But the fact that you had the moon's magnetic field coupling with ours, the two of them together presented a sufficient barrier to solar radiation that it prevented our atmosphere and our surface water from being sputtered away.
So, I mean, Earth doesn't have the moon's magnetic field now, and presumably Earth's magnetic field is not much stronger. Why isn't that a problem today?
Well, number one, the sun isn't as big of a problem as it was back then.
What's changed?
Sun's flaring activity has dropped by a factor of about 100,000 times. So we don't need as strong a magnetic field. The other thing is, with the moon spiraling away, it wasn't really causing much circulation to go on anymore, just a tiny amount today. But what happened was the Earth's core cooled, so you had a solid core and a liquid core, and that set up a different set of convection currents in the liquid core. And so the circulation the moon was responsible for has been replaced by a different kind of circulation. And that wasn't possible in the beginning, because in the beginning, the entirety of Earth's core was liquid. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you've got a solid inner core and outer liquid core, that actually sets up two additional circulation mechanisms.
So, I mean, we're talking about stuff that happened 4 billion years ago. Are there rocks they found? I mean, what is the discovery or the breakthrough that led to this understanding of how the Earth and the moon system work?
Well, they've collected rocks from all over the moon, thanks to the Apollo program. So these rocks have been brought back, and it's literally taken 30 years to fully analyze these rocks and finding this, what they call historical magnetic field in there. They've also had seismographs that they put on the moon. So they've been able to piece together, for the first time, they did kind of a global analytical model, seismic model, magnetic model of the moon that told them how strong the magnetic field was and how stable it was 4 billion years ago. We've had these rocks for a long time, but only now has sufficient analysis been done to tell us accurately what the magnetic field of the moon was 4 billion years ago.
So this isn't just scientists running simulations. I mean, simulations are important, but this isn't simulating, this might be scenarios in the past. It's simulations coupled with some very fine detailed measurements because of the expeditions we've taken to the moon over the last
That's what gave
them
the confidence to publish it, because the computer simulations match perfectly what they were getting from the analysis of the actual measurements.
Well, thanks, Hugh. This is a very fascinating discovery. You know, it is true. When we look at Earth, it is just a place where life thrives, not only in abundance, but in a diversity of ways. And as we investigate how the Earth behaves, the moon and its interactions with the Earth, the sun, the whole sun-Earth-moon system, we see just an immense amount of design, fine-tuning that it's put together to host that thriving, diverse array of life. You know, I would encourage you to go to reasons.org, check out Hugh's blog on this topic. It's called Moon's Early Magnetic Field and How It Makes Human Life Possible. It will give you great information on what's going on in the early history of our solar system, as well as how it allows us to be here, not only to see God's glory, but to go share it with those around.
That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that it helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And don't forget, subscribe to the show and also search for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show. We have a lot of really cool behind the scenes stuff, so be sure to find us there.
That's right. It's all about Instagram stories now, right?
Yep.
If you want to get the podcast version of 2819, we're on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
See you real soon.